So hi, my name is Ewelina Hankiewicz. I'm coming from Würzburg University, and this is my pleasure to chair the last morning session. So we have first two 45 minutes talks, so meaning 30 minutes talk, 15 minutes discussion. And then we have a coffee break and another two exciting talks. And the first talk will be given by Andrea Young, and it concerns superconductivity and quantum anomalous Hall effect in this very excited twisted bilayer graphene heterostructure. Please, Andrea.
Okay, thank you. Okay, yeah, thanks to the organizers for the opportunity to present some of our ongoing work on these moiré systems. So I'm going to try to keep this relatively general and give you kind of an overview of a variety of results, including for those who maybe are not overly familiar with what's been going on in studying correlated states in moiré heterostructures. So I'll try to give an introduction. I'll talk a bit about our efforts to make this system cleaner so that we can try to get more reliable information about what, if anything, is its intrinsic phase diagram, tell you a little bit about high temperature transport, and then discuss some recent results on magnetism and the topology in this system. So by way of introduction, I think many people by now are familiar with the basic idea of twisted bilayer graphene. You take two layers of graphene and you twist them at an angle of about 1.1 degrees. And dating about 8 or 9 years ago, several theoretical groups pointed out that this could be a way to engineer a relatively flat electronic band, right, with the implication that as in a Landau level or a number of other sort of flat band systems studied already in these systems, you might realize a regime where electron-electron interactions are dominant, even though the naive scale of electron-electron interactions is relatively low because the densities in these systems are very low. The kind of technical way this is done, it's in the context of a lot of work I'll tell you a bit about on building van der Waals heterostructures. The kind of clever trick, I think, that's enabled much of this work is actually due to Emmanuel Tatuque at University of Texas, who figured out how to pick up an individual layer of graphene in two pieces. So you can pick up a first half, and then you can pick up a second half, and in between you can control the angle and create twisted bilayer structures encapsulated in the types of hexagonal boron nitride and single crystal gate dielectrics that we like to use in this field. And you can create these twisted structures with an arbitrary angle. And so in their group, they were able a couple of years ago to sort of realize an isolated band this way, close to this magic angle, and then work at MIT the subsequent year showed that at lower temperatures these and closer to this perfect angle of 1.1 degrees, you see insulating states at commensurate filling, meaning at, say, 2 electrons per unit cell, which is indicative of some kind of interaction-driven insulator, because within this band structure, you have a degeneracy of spin and valley at zero magnetic field, so there's no reason why you should have an insulator at 2 electrons per unit cell. You expect insulators at 4 electrons or 4 holes per unit cell, where they are also observed, but you also see insulating states at half filling, so-called, or nu equals 2, as I'll try to refer to it in this talk, and then superconductivity proximal to that insulator. So these superconducting domes, when you dope away from 2 electrons per unit cell. So that's the basic experimental finding, and of course it got everybody very excited. There's actually very similar physics discovered around the same time in a related system. This, I'm not going to discuss this too much because we have not made much progress in working on this system, but it's very similar. It uses a different type of moiré pattern. There's no fine-tuning. You just can put graphene of the right structure, so rhombohedral trilayer graphene, on a boron nitride substrate. You end up with a similar long wavelength moiré pattern, and due to the details of that band structure that you start with and sort of some just some band structure details, you can end up again with an isolated band with a narrow bandwidth and observe much of the similar physics, in particular insulating and resistive peak states, again at partial band filling where you don't expect anything in the single particle model, and possibly superconductivity close to some of these commensurate insulating states. Okay, so there are many questions that are raised by this, right? The most obvious, which of course everybody in the theoretical community got immediately maybe a little overexcited about, is the origin and nature of these insulating states, the origin and nature of the superconductivity, right? Whether they're related to each other. Obviously, this first experiment is extremely suggestive because you have an insulator, which is labeled a mod insulator, and then you have superconducting domes next to the mod insulator, so analogies to cuprates were made, right? But there's a lot of experiment to do. There's a lot of question of what actually controls the phase diagram, what in these materials is responsible for this, and how can you tune it around? As I'm going to show you after a couple of years of working on this, no two samples are ever the same, right? Which is fantastic, because every time you make a new sample, you get a new result, and you can write a paper. But then if the referees ask you to show it in a second sample, then you just submit to another journal. That seems to be the way people are operating, because it's almost impossible to reproduce any specific phenomenology. A few things are robust, but many things are not. And that's actually for a good physical reason, which is that both in the theoretical modeling and as has been evidenced in experiment, there's an extreme sensitivity to small details of the angle, small details of the relationship to the substrate, very likely details of the strain profile that you realize in these structures. So I'll try to show you sort of our efforts to kind of combat this, mostly with sheer brute force of making lots of samples. And I'll try to discuss, in light of that work, which I'll show you, how much of, what do we know about the answer to these questions? Is it indeed like the cuprates in some way? Is it a quantum simulator of a mod insulator, or is that red herring, which for those of you who aren't familiar with that idiom is, something, I think it's from a Sherlock Holmes story, where a red herring appears and it seems like a big clue, right, but it turns out it's just a herring. So we'll see. At least, I'll tell you my opinion about that. So, okay, and then there are other questions beyond this, right, which are, what can we find in the system that's actually, is there something in the system that's actually new for many-body physics, right? After all, I showed you insulators and superconductors. Insulators were discovered in the 18th century when somebody figured out how to put electrical charge in a bottle. Superconductors date back more than 100 years. I'll show you some results on topological physics, including, a quantum anomalous Hall effect. That's getting closer. That was only, 12 years ago that it was discovered. And something called a symmetry broken churn insulator, which is only a couple of years old, so maybe we're catching up to the present in this. Certainly it's true that in this system you seem to be able to realize an awful lot of condensed matter physics that we already knew about, and the question is how to look for things that we didn't already know about. After all, when the first flat band with gate control was realized in the fractional quantum Hall effect, that really moved the needle on how we understand condensed matter physics, and one can hope for the same thing in this system. So, okay, so just to give a brief overview of how we've approached this, so original samples, for reasons I'll discuss later, were clearly not very clean, right? And in fact, we knew at the time that, very similar samples measuring just conventional bilayer graphene systems, we knew how to make them much cleaner. In particular, we knew how to remove charge disorder. So it turned out that when you take graphene and you encapsulate it in boron nitride, that helps a lot. It makes your samples much cleaner. But actually, disorder in conventional graphene, let's say mono bilayer, is still limited by the disorder induced by actually metal gates that you might use. So you deposit some gold, and that doesn't actually have a very uniform work function. So we had solved this in the context of conventional graphene systems by using graphite gates to control it. That gives you one crystal facet and one uniform work function, really reduces the disorder. So the first obvious thing to do was to try to apply this to twisted bilayer graphene. And that was a partial success in that, one could see much better resolved quantum oscillations. This is a plot of resistance as a function of filling factor, and you can see all symmetry broken Landau levels. You can see fractional quantum Hall effect in a twisted bilayer system that shows superconductivity, so that's a good step. That was not true of the first experiments, and so you take that same sample and you look at it. This is at a relatively high temperature of about a Kelvin, and you see that in fact there are commensurate insulating states at 2 electrons per unit cell or 2 holes per unit cell. You also see a new insulating state at 3 electrons per unit cell, and then as you cool it down, you find that indeed there's superconductivity close to 2 holes per unit cell. You also see some new superconductivity at near 2 electrons per unit cell. So some stuff is starting to show up. But actually, when we looked at these samples in more detail, we found that the basic feature of the original measurements from MIT indicating that the sample was disordered was still there. And what is that feature? Basically, you can take a measurement of the critical current of the superconductor as a function of the magnetic field, and you see these interference patterns, right, that are reminiscent of a Josephson junction or a squid or an array of Josephson junctions, right? And that indicates basically that your superconductivity is limited by junctions somewhere in your sample. So it's not a uniform two-dimensional superconductor. So that sort of worked, but it didn't completely work, right? We're still not studying a uniform superconductor. We can imagine superconductivity being kind of percolative in these samples. So how do you remove that? So there was another idea that was, so you know, the basic physics of this system is that you are trying to make a precise angle of 1.1 degrees, right? But 1.1 degrees is not a structural ground state. It's not even a structurally metastable state. You know, graphite wants to be graphite. It wants to be AB stacked. So you're trying to quench it into something that's very close to the structural ground state, but is not the structural ground state. And so what it tends to do is move to zero. And when it doesn't move to zero, it stays wherever you put it. And the way these are made, you're stamping them with polymers. There's strain in them. So you're quenching some structure into these samples that you don't really know about and is very hard to characterize afterwards. And this gets worse the lower twist angle you're at. If you tried to stabilize a 0.1 degree twisted bilayer, it would be a disaster, right? It'd be all over the place. So one way you can try to do this is try to realize this physics at a larger twist angle. Okay, how is that possible? The twist angle itself, right, why 1.1 degrees? It turns out there's a dimensionless parameter that needs to be the right value. And that dimensionless parameter has to do with the twist angle, but it also has to do with the interlayer coupling. So if you can make the interlayer coupling stronger, you can twist it more. Okay, and it turns out there's a way to do that, which is just to apply hydrostatic pressure and squeeze the two layers together. Okay, and there was a prediction around this time of exactly how that works. It's actually relatively elementary once you understand this parameter. So you're just calculating overlaps of wave functions between the two layers. And our collaborator, Corey Dean, had already developed at this point in collaboration with people at High Magnetic Field Lab a way to basically measure these types of devices in a pressure cell, right, and turn up the pressure and study basically electronic effects, right? So that's basically what we did, and we saw that works just fine. So you start at zero GPA this is like a 1.3 almost degree sample, right? It doesn't show much correlation physics, right? You see insulators at plus and minus 4 electrons per unit cells in gray here, and maybe some wiggles, but nothing too dramatic, no superconductivity. But then when you turn up the pressure to 2 GPA, you find that you have full development of these different commensurate insulating states at 1, 2, 3, 4 minus, you know, electrons per unit cell. And superconductivity goes from, you know, you go from a metallic state at a given filling and no superconductivity everywhere to actually very robust insulators with a TC of, you know, 3 Kelvin. Okay? But maybe more importantly, this sample, this, you know, 1.2 something degree sample, shows a somewhat different phase diagram, and particularly shows clean superconductivity. Right, so these are the superconducting domes as a function of temperature, but also as a function of magnetic field. You don't see the kind of here. It's a better picture here. If you look at the critical current versus the magnetic field, you just see kind of uniform-looking behavior. There's no Fraunhofer-type behavior indicative of disorder. Right, so this was kind of a step in that direction. Now, this started already to raise some questions. First of all, there's no dome on this other side. Suddenly, the sample is different. There's a dome only on one side. Okay, so apparently that's slightly different. There's also an interesting fact, which I'll return to, which is that if you look at high temperature, there doesn't seem to be any particular hierarchy between the insulator and the superconductor, right? There's not a sense in which there's an insulating state and then you dope it and there's a superconductor. Rather, you know, if you're at one density, you become superconducting. If you're at another density, you become insulating, right? And this happens right at around the same temperature. Otherwise, they look like metals down to 5 Kelvin or so. And then sometimes they become superconducting, sometimes they can become insulating, depending on the precise doping. Okay, but there's not an obvious separation of energy scales between the superconductor and the insulator. We spent some time exploring this, and given that the time is somewhat short, I'm gonna discuss this only in very short detail. You can look at our paper if you're interested. But you know, one of the interesting things I think that you can do in the system is study, for example, temperature-dependent transport on temperatures that go from, you know, far below the scale of the bandwidth to far above the scale of the bandwidth across doping the entire band, and just try to understand the transport problem when you know that at low temperatures you have these strong correlations, and try to understand what's going on. And of course, you know, there's a large field of people interested in, let's say, high temperature transport in the cuprates or other type of strongly correlated systems, to which this may or may not have anything to do with. Right, and one of the interesting findings is that, you know, there's generically a regime of linear and T temperature dependence in these systems, right? But what we found is basically that this is not correlated in any way with the low temperature correlation physics. It's a generic feature of these systems. It happens whether you're doped close to a superconductor or an insulator. It happens whether you're at the right twist angle for correlations or at pretty wrong twist angle for correlations. And you know, and it happens regardless of density, and you know, it's just always there. There's always this linear and t dependence. You know, comparing this to kind of existing, you know, the main finding that's interesting is that the slope of this linear t dependence is very strongly dependent on twist angle and peaks where the bandwidth becomes small. Okay, even though it's always much larger than it is in monolayer graphene by orders of magnitude, it becomes really huge as you get close to 1.1 degrees. Turns out this is in line with the only available theory at the time, which basically just considered the basic fact that in metals, if you have phonon scattering, that leads to a linear and t dependence, right? But that linear and t dependence actually turns out to depend very strongly on the Fermi velocity. And so if you just plug in these numbers, which is a theory I think by Feng Cheng and Shankar, you basically find that exactly this is the qualitative dependence that you expect, where you get a very large enhancement in this linear t contribution that comes from the fact basically that the Fermi velocity is very small, so it's easy for phonons to scatter. There's a pretty big caveat, though, which I think is interesting and requires further investigation, right, which is the fact that the naive estimates of the deformation potential that you need, right, that you would get from graphene actually give you a considerably smaller effect. And in fact, if you want, one way to put it is that the large linear t enhancement that we observe is observed actually rather farther away from the magic angle than you would expect from this most naive theory, because you need a much larger deformation potential than expected. So this is something that, as far as I know, has not been, this discrepancy is like a factor of 3 in the deformation potential, which is actually more like a factor of 9 in the resistivity. It's not a small quantitative correction, even though the qualitative fact seems to be true. But I think the interesting thing is the discrepancy is really most pronounced actually far from where there's any real correlation physics. So there's something I think still not resolved about the role of phonon scattering. But that said, it's kind of interesting. Now, let's say we just take this and try to think about implications for superconductivity, right? Well, you know, one way to think about this is that, you know, in aluminum, if you measure the linear t dependence and you ask, you know, what does that imply for the strength of electron phonon coupling, right? And then you take that and you put that into a BCS, you get about the right TC, right? This is pretty close. Now, is that going to work in this system? You know, we basically measure lambda transport, as it's known in the old superconducting literature, to be about 1. So that would give us a BCS transition temperature of 700 Kelvin. That's probably not right, but that's not really a good formula here, right? Because this is in the limit where the Fermi energy is very large compared to the Debye temperature, as in metals, right? Whereas, you know, in the opposite limit, which is where we are, where the Fermi energy is very small compared to the Debye temperature, the scale of TC is something closer to the Fermi energy, which is indeed in the scale of tens of Kelvin, right? Which is where superconductivity is observed. So okay, this is sort of circumstantial, right? But something to keep in mind as I show you. So maybe more important is sort of what's happened to the evolution of the known experimental phase diagram since these initial reports, right? So maybe the most interesting thing was just finally published, I think, a couple of weeks ago with an accompanying New York Times article and everything, was work from Dmitry Efetov's group in Barcelona, where they basically showed that superconductivity is not at all restricted to the vicinity of these insulators. Rather, it seems to be, you know, a more or less ubiquitous feature of this system. So they found superconductivity not only close to two electrons and two holes per unit cell, but also close to charge neutrality. And maybe more importantly, it's just completely a feature of the band almost, right? If you don't have some kind of correlated insulating state, you have superconductivity. That's kind of what the pattern recognition of the human brain wants to make of this experiment. It's superconducting nearly everywhere, right? And this seems a bit out of, again, at odds with the idea that the superconductivity is somehow tightly related to, let's say, a proximal correlated insulating state. And since then, we, and also Dmitry, has found that actually this breaks down even more. So in particular, this idea that the superconductor is related to the insulator is not at all generic. Indeed, you know, I'm showing you here two different devices, right? One of them is close to the magic angle, and you see this is as a function of magnetic field. The superconductors are these dark patches at low magnetic field. Their critical fields are on the order of 100 millitesla. But as you look at half filling, you see that there's a strong insulator and then there's superconductors near it. But in a different sample that's farther from the magic angle, you actually see no insulator of any kind, and yet superconductivity, right? So apparently it's possible to get superconductivity without a Mott insulator, right? Without one of these correlated insulators at all. So you know, make of that what you will. So, oops. Let's see. There we go. Okay, so so there's questions about the superconductivity, right? What is its origin? I think there's maybe some, I'll kind of leave it at this point to say that the relationship between the superconductivity and the insulators is simply not clear, right? It seems from a rough phase diagram that I could construct from published data that there's a regime where you have strong insulating states and strong superconductivity, but as you tune the angle away, there's a narrow regime where the insulating states vanish, but superconductivity still persists, okay? TC is higher in closer to the magic angle. Okay, so basically the way I would draw the phase, yeah. Oh, so it's very variable. This is not temperature, first of all, it's magnetic field. This is magnetic field though, not temperature.
No, but it says T.
Oh, this is T, this is 400 millikelvin, that was for a certain. The TCs are extremely variable even at the same angle, right? But the peak TC at the best angle is like 4 or 5 Kelvin. And the TCs that you see when you don't have an insulator at all are closer to 400 millikelvin, you know, on in that order, below a Kelvin. Sample statistics of like 3, right? But that's been the observation so far. You get the most robust insulators and the most robust superconductivity close to the magic angle. Then as you tune away, there seems to be a narrow regime where the insulators are gone, weak superconductivity still persists around the same densities, and then everything interesting is gone, quote unquote. Yes, Andre? Relatively, yeah, not very different.
Mm-hmm.
They're different. This one had to be taken at higher temperatures because of poor contacts. So that makes a pretty big difference for these sort of fine features of the Landau fans. But they are different. The Landau fans are different in every sample, as I'll show you at the end also. Yeah. Very good question. Very good question. So what I'm not showing you here is that we are very careful now, right, to try and make sure that our samples don't look like they're junction limited. That's the best that we can do with transport to check that, right? So it's, you know, in the original experiments from MIT and in the original experiments from our collaboration with Corey, you could see a similar effect, but it was clearly disorder driven and indeed percolation. But what would happen is that when you went above TC, you would see resistivity peaks close to that commensurate filling. If you suppressed it with magnetic field, you would see a resistivity peak. You would typically see a Landau fan, even if in the low temperature limit it was all superconducting, because yes, you have a lot of twist angle disorder.
You can test it with IV, though. Just look at the way critical current behaves.
That's right, and you don't see anything insulator-like in these samples, right? Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
What is the distribution of the tilt angle, the twist angle?
In these samples? We think, you know, so, you know, the best, I don't have the data slide here, I should, but you can basically measure along different contacts as a crude thing and see that they're all kind of within, let's say, 0.01 degrees, right? Other samples that are not good, you know, you will get, and I'll show you a sample that's not good, even though it's the best sample ever from another respect at the end of the talk, right? You know, one set of contacts will show one type of physics, and then every other set of contacts will show completely different physics on sort of few hundred nanometers micron scale. So we think, you know, for these types of samples, they're uniform to within, let's say, 0.01 degree over 5 microns, and we're measuring a 1 micron piece of it, so quite uniform. But there's always some, and that is the critical thing to try and control, that is very hard to control. Okay, how much time do I have left?
7, 8 minutes
before the 15 minutes. Okay. Yeah, sure. Brilliant idea. We're already doing it. You actually don't want to try to move the gate. You do want to try to. So what we're doing is because, you know, the problem is you can't make two samples that are the same, right? So it's the same reason you can't do the isotope effect, right? If every sample you make, 1 out of 3 is superconducting and TC varies by an order of magnitude, you're not going to find a 1% effect. You're not even going to find a 10% effect. You can barely find 100% effects. So instead, what we're trying to do is put a monolayer, let's say 5 nanometers away, and then tune its density of states, right, with another thing and try to just basically control. And initial experiments, which, you know, don't quote me on, suggest that the insulators are slightly affected and the superconductivity is not affected. But these are, you know, that would be the implication, but you know, we need to do this better and make sure that there's nothing weird, right? But that's sort of what we start. That's the first. I'm happy to show you the data afterwards, but it's not great data, but it's certainly wasn't a dramatic, you know, destruction of superconductivity. Okay, so so let me show you something sort of a bit orthogonal, right? Which again takes advantage of the fact that the superconductivity, you know, that the no two samples are the same, right? And that small details make a difference. So so let me just sort of compare data that I showed you before, right? This sample showed basically insulating states at 2 electrons per unit cell, 3 electrons per unit cell, and 2 holes per unit cell, right? But then, you know, a different sample, right? Nominally, we're trying to do the same thing, not obviously different, right? Shows basically only a very robust insulator at charge neutrality, something that's really insulating, nothing at 2 holes per unit cell, a weak, weak resistivity peak at 2 electrons per unit cell, but then actually a quantized anomalous Hall effect at 3 electrons per unit cell. Okay? So it turns out, actually, this wasn't even on purpose. This was just a random chance that the undergrad who was making this stack aligned, for no good reason, the crystal edge of the boron nitride with the crystal edge of the graphene. Okay? And actually worked from David Goldhaber-Gordon's group, had already basically made the argument that this makes a big difference. In particular, it can convert, it can favor a magnetic state close to 3 electrons per unit cell. They didn't see a quantized anomalous Hall effect, but they saw basically that you could get ferromagnetism, right, and see hysteresis. And that's basically what we think is going on here. We weren't trying to do it, but it sort of worked out. And you can see that if you sit yourself at 3 electrons per unit cell and sweep the magnetic field up and down, you basically find that you get a perfectly quantized quantum anomalous Hall effect with E squared over H Hall conductivity, right, and a hysteresis loop that's sort of marked by these several steps inside, right? Like you have a few different little domains that are flipping, right, on the few hundreds of nanometer scale. Okay? It turns out, right, just to get back to what I told you, right, this was actually an earlier generation of samples before we'd figured out how to make them more uniform. Quantum anomalous Hall effect lives between these contacts at the bottom, right? By the time you get out here, you're at like 2+ degrees, right? So there's a huge uniaxial sort of stress in the here, and you know, probably from how these are laminated, and we've since figured out how to do that better. But this one, it only actually looks good down here. Then there's a region that's magnetic but not quantized, and then there's a region that's not even, you have no signs of correlations of any kind.
What temperature do we start
seeing? I will show in a minute. Yeah, give me a couple slides. Right, so the magnetism seems to be pretty broad, right? So it essentially persists almost up to full filling, and almost down to, you know, considerably below 3/4 filling. Actually, this number has gotten lower since I made this slide. The basic feature of the band structure that we're accessing is the fact that, you know, if you do a single particle calculation, right, then these bands typically have, you know, a lot of Berry curvature, or at least incipient Berry curvature. And in particular, what we think is happening is the boron nitride, something that we've known from other studies of graphene for a long time, opens up a gap in the monolayers that you originally started with, and that leads to these isolated bands, and they have finite Chern number generically in these systems. So now, once you have your strong correlations, if you're in a situation that favors polarizing into one of these Chern bands, right, at nu equals 3, that's 1 hole per unit cell, it's every band but one filled, if you simply are filling 1 spin and valley polarized band, you'll get a net Chern number. And that's apparently what is happening. That's a relatively simple situation. One of the important things here, right, is it's not really a spin ferromagnet, right? The anisotropy is all coming from the fact that the valleys are an orbital moment. There's no spin orbit coupling in this system, right? So if you have any doubt about, you know, spin orbit coupling at this point has been measured, there's no way that this is just coming from spin ordering. It's really the anisotropy of the valley orbits, right, which are two-dimensional and know about the lattice, obviously, right, that gives you this kind of icing-like anisotropy in this magnet, right? So indeed, you know, a remarkable thing is it's quite robust in temperature, right? So these are temperature-dependent curves. You can see it's actually quite well quantized up to, let's say, 4 Kelvin, and then it starts to decay, right? But maybe the better thing to do is you can basically look at that quantization. This is in parts per mil, so it's quantized to within a few parts per thousand up to 3 Kelvin, and then it starts to slowly decay at first, but then very rapidly decays for reasons I'll discuss later. If you measure that low temperature dependence of RxY and RxX, you find an activation gap of about 30 Kelvin, right, for the quantum anomalous Hall state. So 30 Kelvin, that's the size of the electronic energy gap, right, that you get from measuring RxX and RxY. But the Curie temperature is only like 7 or 8 Kelvin, right? So the induced electronic gap is several times larger than the Curie temperature, right? You can compare that, for example, to quantum anomalous Hall in magnetically doped topological insulators, right, where, you know, here we took some data and sort of tried to fit old data, and you find that the largest gaps you can get in that system are something on the order of 3 Kelvin in the electronic side, even though the Curie temperatures are 30 Kelvin, 20 or 30 Kelvin, right? So rather than have it be 10 times smaller than the Curie temperature, you have it, you know, several times larger than the Curie temperature, right? And that's more or less consistent, I think, qualitatively. I mean, it's actually not so easy to calculate what this gap is supposed to be, right? That's a rather complicated many-body calculation, but a few MeV seems to be what we've been told by theorists who have done calculations of this type. But it's basically what you'd expect from a clean system, right? That, you know, presumably here the intrinsic gap may be much larger in these doped systems, but as you know, the dopants themselves really reduce that gap. Okay, I'll show you sort of a cool thing, since this is a sort of a topological spintronics type of program, right? I'll show you something that we think is topological spintronics, right? So there's a kind of cool thing you can do here where you put a very small current and you can polarize the domains in your system, okay? So here you're actually sitting at zero magnetic field, right? But you put a small current of just a nanoamp, okay? And you can flip the magnetization in your device, right? Depending on the sign of the DC current, right? And actually, you know, you can do this over and over again. You know, so you put a little current pulse of a few tens of nanoamps, and you measure, and you can just pop, 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 write it up and down, and up and down. So if you want like a stable, you know, non-volatile magnetic memory that only works at exactly 6.5 Kelvin, and for which you can only make one bit at huge cost, then we've got, you know, I've got something to sell you, right? And for which we may never be able to make another bit. And this is sort of relatively reproducible, right? And you know, thanks to Leon, we have kind of a reasonable idea for how this can work. That basically comes from the fact that you have edge states in a turn insulator, right? And it turns out if you drive a DC current, you're actually kind of changing. You know, you can find an I cubed contribution basically to your free energy that comes from the fact that you're driving edge states of one chirality or another on different sides of the sample. So if your sample has any asymmetry between one edge and another, then you'll favor one churn state over another churn state, right? And roughly speaking, to the extent that we know any of these numbers, that seems like a plausible thing. And maybe more importantly, it's certainly a plausible engineerable mechanism. If we can get control over this, this gives you a way to do current-induced switching programmatically, if you can actually control, let's say, just the different lengths of different edges in a uniform intrinsic quantum anomalous Hall system, because it's really there's the very weak pinning in the system is the fundamental point. Okay, so just to close, I'm going to go over my time by a few minutes to show sort of last bit of data of trying to just look at what these actually look like microscopically, right? So there's this beautiful technique developed by the Zeldov group at Weizmann Institute, where they have figured out how to build microscopic squids on the tip of pipettes, right? And for the last few years, we've been building up in my group. And so I'll show you some of our first data from this system. Basically, you know, you have a tiny squid. It's on a tip. You can make it, you know, 100 or less nanometers, and you can get it very close to the sample, and with very good spin and magnetic field sensitivity. So you can get magnetic field sensitivities in the, you know, 10 nanotesla per root hertz, you know, relatively well, easy is not the right word, but it can be done. And then you can do, you know, so the particular measurement that I'll show you, you have this tip, and you can oscillate it because it's attached to a tuning fork, right? So you can effectively measure the gradient of the fringe field close to, let's say, some nanoscale magnet, as you raster scan your tip around. So for example, if you have a domain wall, your fringe magnetic field will look like this, and if you raster the tip perpendicular to that domain wall, you'll see a peak in this tuning fork magnetic field, meaning the tuning fork, the magnetic field you measure at the frequency of the tuning fork that's oscillating, right? And so this is what, you know, initial scans look like. These are rather small signals of just a few tens of nanotesla, and we're imaging down in this region of the device where you have quantized anomalous Hall, and in green are the outlines of the device. And so there are a couple of things I'll just mention. This is still data we're trying to understand. One thing you see is that there's clearly a signal, and there's a signal at the edges, right? And then you also see that there's some structure inside inside the bulk. So this is all real structure. That's not noise. That's above our signal to noise floor. So it turns out there are actually two pieces of different physics, right? One of them we don't understand at all, which is that we see the signal generically along the edges, right? It turns out that's not the ferromagnetism. I'll show you just a slide of that in a minute. But then this internal stuff is indeed the ferromagnetism. So one way we can try to disentangle these is using the fact that we can switch these relatively easily. So we can basically measure, let's say, when we're on the top part of this hysteresis loop, and then we can measure again when we're on the bottom part of this hysteresis loop, right? And the difference there will be the difference in the magnetization between being in these same places. We can actually measure this at exactly the same magnetic field, so everything else is the same. And you can see actually that the sign of these edge features did not change, right? But there's obviously new structure in the bulk. And so if you take that difference, you see that the difference between being in this region of the hysteresis loop, so actually that little jump is significant, and that region of the hysteresis loop, so the thing that leads to this big jump in particular, is this domain, right? That's the difference. Everything else is canceled, but that's what flipped all at once, right? And there's apparently a fair amount of disorder there. Actually, you know, there's not as much disorder down here from before, and this is the good region, and then you sort of start, we think that starts to get twist angle disordered, and then more and more so. I'm not going to get into the details, right? And then you can try to use that to estimate what that orbital moment is, right? And that orbital moment is, you know, on the order of a few Bohr magnetons per moire unit cell, not much more than one, but it is more than one, so it's certainly not just spin. But unfortunately, the theorists had told us it was going to be 10, and so we thought this was going to be easy, and then it turned out to be hard. So, yeah. So anyway, there's also this edge signal we don't understand. I'm happy to talk about it later. I better stop here and just acknowledge the people who did the work and leave some time for questions. So thanks. Yeah.
So can you talk this very exciting talk,
and the talk is open for discussion. Adi, your second.
I will go first. Thanks for the nice talk. The question actually I'd like to ask about the contacts that you use for the superconductivity measurements. Are they superconducting also, or
No, they're usually chrome gold or chrome palladium gold.
Okay. Could you use some super, like niobium or?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
And then the question: can you measure then things like kinetic inductance?
We have an idea of how to do that. It's not easy, but yeah, I think that's possible.
This could be then correlated with the PKT physics.
Yeah, doing that quantitatively, I think, is very challenging. Trying to see at least that you have an imaginary part of your optical conductivity, I think, is possible. The experimental difficulty here is that it remains difficult to make a sample that superconducts at all. So then, you know, if you're trying to do four-terminal transport, that's the easiest measurement known to man. So you can probably do it. If you try to do something more complicated, it means you have to do something complicated plus deal with a sample yield of 10% or less. And it'll get there, but it's not there yet.
Thanks.
So I hope it's a legitimate question. Can you show the slide you
skipped? I didn't show. Yeah, that's my favorite type of question, right? So to continue my talk, I just wanted to share something kind of interesting, which is, you know, that one of the things that I thought might be very exciting about this system is whether you can get something like topological order at zero magnetic field, right? You have all of the ingredients. We have, in a sense, the integer quantum Hall effect at zero magnetic field in this system. Can we get the fractional quantum Hall effect, right? And we know we can do that in a churn band because we've done that in a churn band in the context of Hofstadter bands, right? At high magnetic fields, you can get these very narrow bands, and then you can find fractional churn insulators at partial filling. So can you do this at zero magnetic field? So far, maybe, maybe not, I don't know. We've found some states at non-integer fillings. We don't understand them. I'm not going to show them. They're very fresh. There is something interesting, which we find there are some states at relatively low fields here that they are not fractionally quantized in these churn bands, but they do have a fractional block band filling. right? So we would call these symmetry broken churn insulators, where you have this quantum number s, which tells you how many electrons are bound to each unit cell that is normally an integer for both any sort of non-interacting or even just sort of roughly non-interacting type of state. But we found that there are some fractional ones. The weird thing is that the fraction is a half. So it looks like there's a unit cell doubling, which we never saw in more ordered Hofstadter type physics. But a unit cell doubling in a triangular lattice is a little weird. So it makes us think of stripes or something like that, or some kind of broken rotational symmetry. We see fractional quantum Hall. We haven't looked carefully for fractional churn insulators.
Yeah.
That's microscopically even in this fan. Yeah, but that's kind of close to charge neutrality, where it's kind of Landau levels.
So you see one third.
Yeah. Nothing exotic. But,
yeah. I have two questions. First question is, you mentioned that you have a large piece of twist barrier graphene. One side is quantum monism horror. One side is superconductivity. Mm-hmm. Then this is very orbital moment. My question is, what's the intermediate region when you have a co-.
Right, so I didn't say that. I said that one side in this sample we have quantum anomalous Hall, and the other side we have no correlations of any kind and nothing interesting. We don't know whether that sample superconducts. We've never measured it below 1.5 Kelvin. It may or may not. We've been busy doing imaging. We haven't been able to reproduce it. Good question of whether something interesting can happen at an interface between an anomalous Hall state and one of these intrinsic superconductors. Exciting. There's no sample that I know of that shows both at this point.
I see.
Yeah.
My second question related to your current switching. But for ferromagnetism, there's a spin and angular momentum conservation, so the spin gives a magnetizing torque. In your study, is a very orbital moment. So you flow a current, and so the very orbital moment is related with the domain or the local twisting of this bilayer. So I was wondering, where is this torque coming from?
So, this yeah, good question. I think the idea of kind of torques of that kind and forces on domain walls, I think Yaroslav has written about that in Quantum Anomalous Hall, and there are a few other papers. That wasn't what we were thinking of, and that's I think that those mechanisms must also be there. But the thing that we think might be relevant and are trying to figure out how to probe more directly is kind of, doesn't rely on that. It's just basically a comparison of, is the free energy lower when you have a current in one direction or another for a churn state in one direction or another.
Well, can I ask a question related to that? Have you looked at the dependence on the current pulse width and then related to the numbers of electrons you need to switch?
We haven't. No, we have not. That's a good question. We have not done that, but we will think about doing that.
If I could ask one, so do you actually see also the Landau levels, further in the magnetic field? So you see quantum anomalous Hall, but obviously in the other regimes, you also see the Hall plateau. So is it just because of disorder, or, what is really pinning the...
Sure. In this sample, we also see Landau levels. There's a very complicated fan. I don't have this data, but generically in these systems, you have Landau levels, and then you have these churn insulators. Often they're field-induced. So for example, in some of these samples that show superconductivity without insulators, if you go to a few Tesla, suddenly you have a bunch of churn insulators. Things that, phenomenologically, they're not so different from a Hall plateau, but they're pretty clearly coming from kind of a somewhat different mechanism. It seems like you're kind of polarizing into a churn band. So in general, the fans are very complicated, and you have both Landau levels and churn insulator physics. I'm sorry it's not better resolved, right? But these are Landau levels, and then this is actually a churn insulator originating from minus one electron per unit cell, and all of this stuff is very tightly tuned by density.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So do we know about the pairing symmetry of the superconducting state now? Okay.
Of course not. It was very hard to do in any superconductor, right? It's certainly not hard to do here.
On the question of the orbital origin of the moment, do you, or can you look at the field in the plane?
Yeah,
would that be able to distinguish?
We're not set up to do it right now. We will be N months from now. It's the right thing to do, but not with scanning. We may be able to do it with transport, but we haven't done it with transport yet. Yeah. With transport, we could do it, but not while we're scanning, so which is what we're doing right now. So.
Okay, last question.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about this topological thing. I guess the role of the boron nitride is very important there. Is it possible to change the substrate or the encapsulation?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
If this is just the usual graphene, or there is something particular to the twisted binding?
Yeah, so I think the thing that we've learned in the last years is that there's no substrate that has no effect, but different substrates have different effects. So maybe I'll turn the question around to you. Which would you rather have, a substrate that may break sublattice symmetry or a substrate that'll induce a little bit of spin orbit? That's your choice that we know of at this point that can keep graphene clean. We can either turn on a little spin orbit or we can turn on a little AB sublattice symmetry breaking.
Graphite would do the same as an encapsulate.
Graphite is conducting and won't let us do any measurement. Yeah. So we need insulators. Yeah.
Okay, so let's find Andrea again.